Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Remember the 1990s? Of course you do, unless you were born in the year 2000 or later. And if that's the case, we here at Beta should pat ourselves on the back for attracting such a young demographic. Well done, gents. Woo-hoo! But I digress. Chuck Klosterman remembers the 1990s. He spent most of his 20s during that decade. And he's written what will probably be considered the definitive book about this time period. It's called The 90s. Chuck explores everything you wanted to know about the 90s and some things that you might be afraid to remember.
Emphysema.
I'm the king of the world!
Cringeworthy, Chuck shared his understanding of the 1990s with us.
I guess to me, if you're essentially trying to understand the period in a kind of an abstract way, it would probably be the prevalence of the idea of selling out and how that sort of complicated the lives of any young person in the 90s with aspirations to do almost anything, that they had to factor in this specific way of understanding fame and success that consistently seemed to be create like a psychological obstacle toward just going out and being who you were. You always had to consider how that was perceived within the context of fame or success. I really feel like selling out is what the 90s were about, not the activity, but the fear of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You say that Nirvana's album Nevermind, which was released in 1991, is the official launch of the 90s and that it is the ideal mainstream version of counterculture ideology. How so?
Well, you know, there's a kind of a conventional way to frame the 90s. We never go exactly by the calendar because culture doesn't really care about clocks or calendars. But the conventional take on when the 90s began and when they ended is that they began when the Berlin Wall fell in autumn of 89, and then they end at 9/11. I don't see the 90s beginning in 89. And the reason I feel that way is because 1990, the year itself, was sort of the 1980s on autopilot. Many of the things that we associate with the 1980s were still very central to the year 1990. I mean, sure, like Twin Peaks begins that year, and that seems new, but it's kind of a fringe concern. The most popular show is still Cheers. You know, Joe Montana is still the best player in the NFL. People are still shopping through catalogs and buying, you know, Garfield phones from the JCPenney catalog around Christmas. The New Kids on the Block had a major tour in 1990. It wasn't until the release of Nevermind that we see sort of the values we now associate with that period becoming the main values of youth culture. And the rippling effect in a non-musical way that Nirvana had sort of on society is pretty profound. I talk about a commercial for a Subaru Impreza starring Jeremy Davis, an early role he would later go on to be like in Saving Private Ryan and TV shows like Lost. But yes. He's describing this Subaru car.
Do you remember when rock and roll was really boring and corporate? Well, punk challenged all this and said, hey, excuse me, but here's what's cool about music, remember? Now, Subaru, with this Impreza, is challenging some car thinking here. This car is all about reminding you and me what's great about a car and moving forward and making cars better and less disappointing. Just like punk, except it's cars.
And what he's really trying to do is appeal to people who would normally buy a Honda Civic, but they're trying to sell them these Imprezas. The analogy he uses is punk rock, how this car is like punk rock. And he jumps back to the idea of the 1970s, where, you know, I guess bands like Jethro Tull and Yes had made rock boring. So then these punk bands came in and changed everything. But what he's really talking about is Nirvana. He can't talk directly about Nirvana because they would never participate in a car commercial. It would also be a situation where if he actually used Nirvana as the example, it would have had the opposite effect. It would have seemed like he was trying hard, too hard. So he had to talk about Nirvana without talking about Nirvana. And how do you do that? Well, it's by suggesting that your product, whatever you're trying to sell, sort of contains the values alleged by Nirvana themselves, which was chiefly a real discomfort with any kind of conventional success, to the point where the idea of being super famous was not seen as the achievement of your career, but really humiliating. And I think that a lot of these ideas, like we talk about selling out and all these things, I mean, like, this is something Nirvana was dealing with because what had always happened in the past is there had been a tension between mainstream culture and underground culture. So it was understandable for the underground to look at mainstream success with a lot of skepticism and sort of see it pejoratively. But then Nirvana kind of, not accidentally, but not necessarily aggressively, becomes the biggest band in the world. So then we have a situation where somebody who identifies as the underground is now the absolute top of the pyramid. And that became a real paralyzing thing for them. And in a lot of ways, the most important things about Nirvana was not the songs they made, but sort of how they felt about those songs being beloved.
Yeah, exactly. In one of my favorite chapters, you talk about Quentin Tarantino's 1992 film, Reservoir Dogs. Why could this movie only be made in the 90s?
You know, the 70s had been a time in film that was a director's medium. So probably the greatest period film may ever experience was, you know, was the certainly the first half of the 1970s. In the 1980s, it became more of a producer's medium. So you did see more kind of formulaic filmmaking. Film was not as good in the 80s as it had been in the decade before. But then in the early 90s, there's this explosion in independent film. It wasn't just that they were directing these films. They were writing them. They were directing them. They had almost complete control over everything. And he is an example of somebody who represents how the VCR and video cassettes really changed filmmaking. I mean, you know, the VCR is a 1980s thing, okay? It's the story of the VCR is an 80s story. That's when they sort of became something that people commonly own. They'd been too expensive in the past, and suddenly it was very easy to own one. And that, of course, led to the creation of the video store. And what the video store did is it allowed people who didn't live in Los Angeles or New York to have access to a much wider library of film, where they could create their own sort of personal specific film canon. And someone like Quentin Tarantino, in the movie like Reservoir Dogs is an example of this, this is a movie that someone might think, oh, well, this guy must have had some family relationship to organized crime. In fact, like Harvey Keitel, when he read the script, just assumed, because Tarantino has an Italian name and didn't know this guy, he must have had like some criminals in his family history, and was shocked to find out that, you know, Quentin Tarantino was a guy from Tennessee who then moved to LA with his mom and had no crime at all in his life. All he had was crime movies. And a movie like Reservoir Dogs is not about life. It is about the world of crime as it had been expressed in other films.
No, he ain't familiar. He ain't one of Cabot's soldiers either. He's gotta be from out of town. Joe knows him real good.
How can you tell?
The way they talk to each other. You can tell they're real buddies.
Two of you talk?
Who, me and Joe?
Mr. White.
A little.
About what?
Brewers.
Milwaukee Brewers?
Yeah. Apparently they won the night before. He made a killing off him.
This is sweet, man, because if this crook's a Brewers fan, his ass has got to be from Wisconsin. And I bet you everything from a diddle dad Joe to a damned if
so what you see in the 90s is this idea of content being built out of content. You could go into a Blockbuster, and there was enough content in one Blockbuster to almost usurp all of actual reality. And this is where you see, this is part of the reason why it was so common in the 90s to classify things as postmodern. There was this idea that we were now moving beyond what had been sort of the modern idea of filmmaking, which is, you know, represent life, capture life, and now make it this very subjective thing where somebody could kind of take their idea of a fictionalized life and then make it hyper-real on screen.
Yeah, that's a very good point. As you point out, almost everything about television that was recognized in the early 90s can be boiled down to one three-second clip from the fourth season of Seinfeld. What is that clip?
Well, it's a clip from an episode called The Pitch. And this is a two-part episode where the main characters, Jerry Seinfeld and George Costanza, who's really a stand-in for Larry David, Jerry's real-life friend, they're trying to make a TV show based kind of on the banality of their own life, which is what Seinfeld was. Like, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld make a TV show about them just sitting around talking about, you know, what they find mildly amusing. And then within the reality of that show, they're trying to make another level. They're trying to make a show called Jerry. Okay, that's good, like about their own life. And they're pitching this show to NBC.
Oh, no stories.
No stories? So what is it?
What did you do today?
I got up and came to work.
There's a show. That's a show.
How is that a show? Well, maybe something happens to you on the way to work.
No, 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 nothing happens.
Well, something happens.
Well, why am I watching it?
Because it's on TV.
Not yet.
That just seems kind of obtuse and just sort of a throwaway, but it really does reflect how differently television was viewed just a short time ago. I mean, the 90s aren't that long ago. Like, you know, we're not looking back on, like, some period before World War II. It's relatively close to us in kind of the historical lineage. But things like the way we view television have changed entirely. Things like appointment television, this television show you had to watch. The idea that if someone watched a TV show and you had yet to watch it, they can't talk about it because it will spoil it. Nobody would have ever thought that in the 90s. Like, it was more likely to say, I don't even own a TV. That was a popular thing people said. TV yeah. was seen as very, very inferior to theatrical film. You could tell someone on a television show was really successful because they would leave TV and make a movie. So this idea that George was expressing was like, you know, what people want to do is turn the television on and see what's there. And if we put this on, people will do that. Because the idea was that television was still a very passive experience. It was what you did when there was nothing else better to do. And that just happened to be most of the time.
Yeah. You were in your 20s for most of the 90s, and in an essay you wrote for Grantland in 2011, you analyzed what you called the nostalgia problem. Do you think nostalgia was a problem for you while you were writing the 90s?
You know, when people talk or write about this book, they use the word nostalgia inevitably. I think people look at the cover of this book and they see this old phone and they're like, oh, I remember having that phone or know someone who had that phone, and they kind of feel a sense of nostalgia. But people sometimes confuse the concept of nostalgia with just the activity of remembering things. I mean, to me, nostalgia means you're looking back in an event and you're using your own emotional relationship to change how that event seems in your memory. This is why somebody who grew up during the Depression can look back at the 30s and say, oh, it was such a wonderful time. They're remembering things about themselves that had no relationship to the status of the country, injecting that back into the memory and changing what it is. This book is not nostalgic in that way. Like, I wrote Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs 20 years ago. That's also a book about the 90s. But that was a very personal book about the 90s. That was about my life and the things I cared about and my understanding of reality through the things I was into. This book isn't like that. I mean, I'm not in this book. I looked at this much more as a, I don't want to say academic, but it was a process that did not involve my feelings. I don't think that I'll look back on this book and be embarrassed by it in 20 years. Because there are things from my early books that I know if I went back and reread, I would be embarrassed by. I guess not because they were published, but because I would be like, I'm just, that person's not me now. And to a lot of people, it always will be, because this might be the only thing they know about me. This one book they read once, you know?
Can you give me an example of something you'd be embarrassed about? You're embarrassed about it in your previous books?
Okay, so my third book was called Killing Yourself to Live. And, you know, there's a lot of things in that book that, to me, like, are kind of amazing that they happened. Like, I met my wife while writing that book. I was writing that book in kind of a diary form. So there's a few pages in Killing Yourself to Live where I literally explain what happened on the night I met my wife, written the day after it happened. I mean, I'm sure anybody listening to this interview is like, oh, I remember when I met my spouse, but you probably didn't go home and write about it, you know, that night by chance. Yeah. So in that way, it's really incredible to me. I have these personal details of my life captured in this way that I could have never anticipated. But that said, I would never write a book like that again. I would never talk so candidly about my own interior life, and I would absolutely never talk so casually about other people. I mean, I talk about various women that I had relationships with in that book, and I just did it. I just didn't think about what it meant. I just did it, you know? I guess in my mind, I thought, well, you know, if they wrote a book about their relationships and I was in it, I'd be interested. I'd be curious. But of course, all people aren't that way. Like, some people don't feel that way. So, you know, I think of, like, my first three books, which I'm sure to some people will always be the books of mine they like the most, as these things that I wouldn't do anymore. because it's just, I would not write about my own life because that would mean writing about my relationship with my wife, writing about my kids, you know, writing about these things that are, that now to me seem kind of too intimate and personal to use as a commodity. But maybe that's 90s thinking. Maybe in some ways it's me finally catching up to this idea of selling out and sort of what, integrity and all these things, things that I refuse to do just to be successful. Because I'm always pushed to write more about myself in this book. I'm sure my publisher and my agent would have loved me to do a first-person telling of the 90s. I know they would have. But that's not who I am anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you mentioned, you've kind of covered that in Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. Chuck Klosterman, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Congratulations on the 90s.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of The 90s. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
I think that food has a unique ability to help us get to dialogue and to understanding in a way that other conversation and other vessels just simply cannot.
Coming up, Stephen Satterfield talks about his Netflix docuseries, High on the Hog, how African-American cuisine transformed America. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.